Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new report from Oxfam, Reward Work, Not Wealth, which coincides with the Davos World Economic Forum that President Trump is attending in Switzerland, the theme of which this year is Creating a Shared Future in a Fractured World. Paul O'Brien, the Vice President for Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam America, joins us to assess whether the sudden growth in income inequality across the globe, that in a period of 1 year has created a new billionaire every other day, will be adequately addressed by a group of world leaders and billionaires at this Mar-a-Lago in the Alps. We will look into what drives this reversion towards a form of global feudalism, where the world's 8 richest people have the same wealth as the poorest 50% of the planet, and why this trend of having a handful of oligarchs sitting on top of a vast global peasantry is accelerating, with 82% of the wealth generated last year going to just 1% of the global population, while 3.7 billion people who make up the poorest half of the world saw no increase in their wealth. Then we'll speak with Peter Schrag, the former editorial page editor of the Sacramento Bee, who has written for The Nation for nearly half a century, about his latest article at The Nation, California Shows How to Beat Trump, Now and in November. We'll discuss how the Golden State is fighting back in Trump's war on California, as his administration tries to reverse the legalization of marijuana, open up offshore drilling, defund sanctuary cities, round up the undocumented, and punish the world's 6th largest economy by raising taxes on its citizens in a so-called tax reform bill that is not just a gift to the 1%, but a petty act of Republican partisanship. Then finally, progressive activist and blogger at downwithtyranny.com, Howie Klein, joins us in the studio. A concert promoter, disc jockey, music producer, record label founder, record label executive, and professor of music who was president of Reprise Records, joins us to discuss how California can go a long way towards flipping the House in November by unseating Republican congressmen who sold out their constituents. And we will assess the difference between grassroots candidates running for office and those the Democratic Party establishment favors. And joining us now is Paul O'Brien, who's the Vice President for Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam America, where he oversees research, policy, advocacy, and campaigning work to influence the U.S. government and U.S. corporations. Previously, he worked in Afghanistan for 5 years in the Office of the President and the Ministry of Finance, and as an advisor on aid coordination, development planning, and policy reform. And he joins us to discuss the new report at Oxfam, Reward Work, Not Wealth. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul O'Brien.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, your report coincides with the annual Davos meeting in the Swiss Alps. And of course, the World Economic Forum's stated mission is improving the state of the world. And of this year's forum, its motto, if you will, is creating a shared future in a fractured world. So I must say, from my point of view, Paul, it's basically seems as though, and perhaps this is unfair, that what happens at Davos is a bunch of billionaires sit around in hot tubs drinking Dom Perignon, fretting about the state of the world, and they're the winners. And what your report indicates is that most of us are the losers.
Well, Ian, I'd agree with you that they are definitely the winners, and we have a big problem on our hands with structural inequality. The last year, since the last time we did this Davos report, 82% of the wealth that got generated went to the top 1%, while the poorest half of humanity, that's 3.7 billion people, got nothing in terms of that extra wealth. So it's been a bad year for structural inequality. The optimist in me says that Donald Trump is going to get a bit of a surprise when he arrives there, because I think he does think that they're going to sit around in hot tubs and smugly remind each other and themselves how well they've done off the backs of everyone else. And I think he's actually going to get two surprises. I think the first one is they have been struggling with this question for some time. Yes, we're wealthy. Yes, we're the winners. But is this structural inequality ultimately going to destabilize the very world from which we've been able to profit? And increasingly at Davos, the answer has been yes. They are at the very least, and it's far from enough, having a serious conversation about inequality. And there's not a lot of smugness to that conversation, including inviting us to lecture them. The second thing I think Trump will be surprised by is where the conversation that's happening amongst women leaders is also coming up against the inequality conversation. There are a lot of strong women leaders who are insisting that Davos this year is a different kind of conversation that addresses front on what's been happening for women in the global economy and what we're going to need to do to fix it. Happy to share some stats with you on that if that's helpful.
Well, but so in effect, even though some people have described Davos as perfectly fitting for Trump and for his crowd because it's sort of like the Mar-a-Lago of the Alps, you don't see it that way. There's enough dissent in there to really capture the agenda?
Look, it's a problem that we've seen more billionaires created over the last year than at any other time since we've been measuring it. We've seen a new billionaire every 2 days, so they're going to have to build more accommodation in Davos just to keep all these people happy, more mansions. Do we like the fact that the world's elite get to gather far away from everyone else and talk about things? It's not a particularly reassuring thing for us that problems are going to get solved. But if you have a moment where the economic elites are coming together, you want to make sure that they use that moment to have real conversations. And yeah, I do think there are people at Davos who want to use the forum with heads of state, with people who are running large corporations, to ask, are we actually going up a dead-end street with this global economy? And we think we are, and we think they are increasingly understanding that it's not in their long-term interest to ignore what's happening to the global economy.
So already Justin Trudeau has spoken. The Australian actress Cate Blanchett, who is a goodwill ambassador for the UN refugee program, made a speech where she, I think, sort of got a dig at Trump, who championed, as we know, in the elections, this sort of mythical idea of the forgotten man when he passes so-called tax reform that rewards the billionaires. But she turned that around and talked about the forgotten people and the forgotten conflicts. So is that a place to start when we talk about wealth inequality? What's even worse and more alarming, I think, is the fact that so many of our fellow citizens on this planet are displaced and in dire situations.
Entirely right. You know, we're an anti-poverty organization, first and foremost. We came to inequality because we realized that if you didn't address it, you wouldn't actually solve poverty. We now have a global economy. It's probably worth about $74 trillion, where there's another $10 trillion in the care economy, which is essentially unpaid work that women are doing. We have 100 different countries, many of which we work in, where women aren't allowed to do the same jobs as men. Another more than 150 where laws actually prevent them from having the same rights as men in the workplace. So we have experienced as Oxfam, working alongside communities, a chronic problem of people being stuck. We work with women in Vietnam who, as garment workers, cannot live in the same communities as their children. They have to travel many, many miles in order to be able to do a job which can feed their families. We work with poultry workers in the United States, where women on the line literally have to wear diapers because they're not allowed by their bosses to go to the toilets. In Canada, where Justin Trudeau is a very strong spokesperson for gender rights, we work with women hotel workers who are scared of reporting sexual harassment because they're going to get fired. The same is true for those workers in the Dominican Republic. So all around the world, we're seeing a reality of structural inequality actually trapping people in poverty while you're seeing a new billionaire being created by this economy every 2 days.
So what is the structural reason then, Paul O'Brien, for what appears to be that we are reverting back to a kind of medieval age where you basically have a few members of the elite and then this vast peasantry and then a small professional class that some people have referred to as the wealth protection class, lawyers and accountants, etc.? What's happened to turn the clock back so much? Because that's the only historical example that I can find that really fits the current situation.
Well, you know, I'd actually like to turn the clock back just 2 years, because I would have given you a very different answer, well, maybe two and a half years ago, 2015. 2015, we thought we were finally putting in place the rules of an international order that would allow people to lift themselves out of poverty. What you saw in those years around then was what we thought was an increasingly global consensus that you needed to regulate corporations, you needed to ensure that governments spent more of their funding on things like the Sustainable Development Goals, which covered the gamut from health and education to safer industries, addressing climate change, reducing inequality. And all these folks came together. I was in Addis Ababa, where I watched them talk about the financing for this and how governments were going to commit more of their money to raise better taxes, to spend it smarter. You had in the United Nations of that year in September, you had them all commit to a truly holistic set of sustainable development goals for all countries. You had the climate change agreement give us confidence that we were going to tackle the problem that we were destroying our planet. It was a good year, not to solve the problems you're talking about for that class that feels left behind, but to put in place the rules so that the money that's in this global economy would go to the right places. What we've seen in the last 2 years is an effort, sometimes intentionally, in part by Donald Trump and by others, to dismantle many of those agreements. We've taken a huge step back over the last 2 years. The optimist in me says this is not going to be a long-term spiral downwards. Eventually, people in the United States and around the world are going to want to get back to a more accountable, transparent, and open government that truly serves the needs of people everywhere. So I think that's coming back in the not-too-distant future.
Well, clearly, with Xi Jinping, I think he was there last year as a keynote speaker, promoting the idea of global trade and globalism. Donald Trump has come in with a kind of nativist anti-trade policy, although he's got some Goldman Sachs people with him, his Secretary of Treasury and the head of his Economic Council. But, of course, the first shot in what could devolve into a trade war was tariffs being slapped on by Donald Trump on washing machines and solar panels. And that strikes many people in this country and probably around the world as an enormously reactionary step, not so much in terms of stimulating a trade war, but the idea that this is a president who wants to bring back coal that the market has rejected, and it's the worst thing possible for the environment, and punish the new economy of solar. So there seems to be a real, it's not even atavism, it's some kind of weird, talk about turning back the clock. What do you make of that? Because we are an outlier, you know, we've pulled out of the Paris Accords, etc. I don't understand what the agenda is here, frankly.
Yes, well, I agree with much of that. I'll tell you how I would characterize it in Oxfam's concern. What we fight for as a rights-based organization is that governments are accountable to take their natural resources and make sure that their national resources, the resources of their people working productively and fairly in non-discriminatory workplaces, and the natural resources that are in their ground and that can lift so many countries out of poverty. What we had in the last administration, we had many problems with the Democrats, many problems with President Obama. But one thing we did see was a firm commitment to ensure that American corporations, American investments led a long-term race to the top, so that when China offered its wealth and options to African countries, there was a real choice. America would set standards on transparency, on accountability, and would make sure that well-governed democratic societies spent their wealth on their people. That was the standard we set. What Donald Trump did, practically in his first day of in office, was to say those executive orders which required American companies to report their deals with developing country governments, get rid of them. He literally got rid of all of those constraints on American companies so that they could go back to making secret deals with those governments. Now, this week, we're facing legislation which is going to turn that decision into law. We're going to lose the reforms that were made to make American companies much more transparent in how they engage around the world. You started by asking the question about China. What makes us different from China is that we believe in the connection between good politics and good economics. An open and free society allows people to work more productively. China's perfectly happy to work in a world where you don't have people questioning the behavior of leaders and can just use your wealth to make deals. What Donald Trump is doing is essentially very short-term and not in America's long-term interests.
Well, frankly, I think it's a different subject from the one we're discussing, but I think one of the great challenges on the planet is that democratic institutions are under attack by kleptocratic autocracies. You've got a kleptocratic autocracy in Russia, in China, in Turkey, in the Philippines. It's the list is growing. And I think the rule of law is, not just democracy, but the rule of law is under assault. So there's a kind of a pretty wide panoply of problems here.
Yes, and it is connected back to what's going on in Davos, because the growth of authoritarianism and the growth of isolationism and the growth of populism, if you're somebody who has made your wealth from a functioning global economy in which new marketplaces open up, more consumers are both prosperous enough and free enough to be able to buy your Facebook or Google or other products, this stuff, growing authoritarianism, growing isolationism is profoundly threatening. So we don't think that they're having conversations about structural inequality and these risks to political stability out of charitable magnanimity. We think they're doing it because it's in their long-term self-interest as the winners of the global economy to make sure it stays stable enough to continue to see a thriving global economy.
Well, indeed, I think they're probably aware that things could get worse. I mean, it's bad enough having Trump and having Brexit, but there could be even more destructive populist leaders in the pipeline if more and more social discontent takes place, surely.
That's right. That's our concern, too, that politics and economics have to work together for people to lift themselves out of poverty. And over the last couple of years, we've seen a very nasty trend on both fronts.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I'd like to get your, since you've worked in Afghanistan for 5 years in the Office of the President and in the Ministry of Finance, is there a connection here between what we're talking about in terms of inequality and growing inequality around the world and this kind of growing nihilism that's represented by the Islamic State and by the Taliban? I mean, murdering a bunch of aid workers in that hotel that just took place where the guards just abandoned the people they're supposed to protect is pretty grim. But this has been going on. It seems to be getting worse. And that's, of course, the longest war in America's history and one in which they've made massive investments with little to show for it. So it seems that it's very easy in this world for a small group of nihilistic, I don't even know what motivates them, but nihilistic, murderous people to destabilize entire countries and talk about turning back the clock in terms of what the Taliban and the Islamic State represent.
That's right. So I have to be a little careful and thoughtful of colleagues who are facing a very difficult situation right now. It isn't just the Intercontinental Hotel, but I think you've probably heard today the offices of Save the Children in Jalalabad were attacked by extremists. And this is an organization that has been a voice for peace, for children, for women, and have been in Afghanistan for a very long time. I know lots of staff that work for Save the Children. They are the finest example of the humanitarian spirit, and it is tragic that they were targeted. But you ask, really, what is driving this kind of militantism that is willing to target even those who've come to help their families live a slightly better life and survive the worst of crises? I do think if we can't offer a set of ideas that can win over all of those Afghans, the vast majority of Afghans who want to be part of the international community, who want to be proud of their country as a peaceful, prosperous nation. They are remarkable as a people. And the vast majority of them are not zealots in favor of the United States or zealously opposed to the United States. They're trying to eke out a living and do the things that will allow their children to live better. And they make their minds up with every act that we engage in their environments. When we help them in constructive ways, when we support their government to be more open and democratic, when we take the long-term approach, they're smart about it. And they say, we want to be part of that because we want a better life for our children. When our bombs, albeit unintentionally, destroy their homes and kill innocent civilians as collateral harm in our war on terror, we lose whole communities. So it is absolutely critical that economically and politically we keep the Afghan people at the forefront of our minds in the way we promised to do in the aftermath of 9/11. It's a hard ask because this war has been going on for so long, but I do know that the actions that are taken over the next couple of years are going to help most Afghans to decide which side of the line they want to be on.
Well, Paul O'Brien, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Paul O'Brien, who's the Vice President for Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam America, where he oversees research, policy, advocacy, and campaigning work to influence the U.S. government and U.S. corporations. And Oxfam has a new report, Reward Work, Not Wealth. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing how the Golden State is fighting back in Trump's war on California.
That lingers in your ear, but you can't forget from sundown to sunset. Nah, nah. It's all in the air, you hear it everywhere. No matter what you do, it's gonna grab a hold on you. California soul. California soul.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Peter Schrag, who has written for The Nation for nearly a half century and is a former editorial page editor of the Sacramento Bee and a visiting scholar at the Institute for Governmental Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of Paradise Lost, California's Experience, America's Future. And his most recent book is When Europe Was a Prison Camp, Father and Son Memoirs, 1940-1941. And his latest article at The Nation is California Shows How to Beat Trump Now and in November. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Schrag.
My pleasure.
And the idea of beating Trump, of course, is music to my ears. And of course, California State Senate Leader Kevin DeLeon mentioned to The Guardian back in the beginning of January was that there is no doubt that President Trump has officially declared war on California. And of course, along with Trump, you've got Sessions wanting to prosecute medical and recreational marijuana. You've got the Secretary of Interior allowing oil drilling off California's coast. And again, you've got Sessions wanting to intensify the deportation of immigrants and also now go after sanctuary cities. And on top of that, of course, the ultimate insult to the state of California is the GOP tax plan, which is petty, entirely designed to punish California, capping deductions for state and local taxes at $10,000. So that's a brief litany of Trump's attack on us. What's the counterattack?
Well, I think there are two things that are going on. The counterattack is first a set of lawsuits that have been filed primarily by Javier Becerra, our attorney general, on a whole number of issues and threatened other suits on the wall at the border, suing on the threat from Sessions that certain Justice Department funds for local law enforcement would be withheld to places that are sanctuary cities. He's filed a whole string of suits on environmental issues, on immigration, So there's that. Then there's the state bill, which is called, I can't remember what it's called now, but it was essentially a kind of a quasi-state sanctuary law that would essentially require, or let's say would prohibit local law enforcement from working with federal immigration authorities in enforcing immigration laws. There's obviously all our sanctuary cities. The Air Resources Board has reaffirmed its commitment to various tough auto emission standards, despite warnings from the feds that they would crack down on us. So it's been a whole series of things. But I think the more important thing, and I think that gets maybe lost in this story, is that California's history for the last 25 years has been an exemplary history of a state that in 1994 was trying to do exactly what Trump is trying to do now, is to basically kick out illegal immigrants. And we passed Proposition 187, which would have denied public schooling and a lot of other public services to undocumented immigrants. We are now, of course, as I said, we're now in official position of essentially welcoming undocumented immigrants. We now let them compete for scholarships or financial aid at public universities. We've done a whole series of things to protect undocumented immigrants. So we've changed 180 degrees. In addition to this, California, obviously, as we know, is a majority-minority state. Whites are just another minority. White and non-Hispanic whites are just another minority. Sooner or later, Latinos will be a majority in California, an absolute majority in California. And California, and of course, California with its tough environmental laws and its tough regulatory scheme, has in fact become economically very successful. We're the sixth largest economy in the world. We are creating any number of new industries, new businesses. All of that, it seems to me, is an example of what the un-Trump Commonwealth can be. And it seems to me that California, as an exemplar, as a model for the rest of the nation, I think is as important as its actual resistance in protecting that model against all the war, let's put it, to use Kevin DeLeon's words, the war that the Trump administration and Congress are waging on California. And I think we shouldn't forget that this is not just Trump. This is the Republican Congress, which has been an enabler for Trump, which was essentially articulating a lot of the same positions that Trump has been, if we can even decide exactly what Trump is for and against, which I'm not always sure, and nobody else is really sure. Maybe Trump's not sure. But in any case, the Republican Congress has been hostile to a great deal of what's been going on in California for many years. That's a long answer to a short question.
Right. Well, I know that there's an effort underway to figure out, first of all, California gives much more money back to the federal government than they get in return. And essentially what that means is we are subsidizing Alabama and Mississippi and all these Tea Party reactionary states that are trying to punish California, or at least their representatives are. And I know there's an effort underway to get around this appalling FCC ruling on net neutrality at the state of California level. But in terms of getting around the punishment of not allowing the deduction on state and local taxes, which means Californians' tax bill goes up, it's a direct punishment for being a successful and progressive state. What is being done at that level?
Well, as you know, there's a lot of talk in Sacramento about that, and elsewhere as well, in New York State, for example, about trying to create some kind of alternative, a choice where a taxpayer could essentially, in lieu of paying taxes, he would donate the equivalent to a charitable fund, whatever, and use the charity as a charitable deduction. I'm not sure that would work. I'm not sure the IRS would allow it. But there's talk of that kind of thing. The other alternative, and I think that's the much bigger alternative and more plausible, is to basically elect a Democratic Congress. And it seems to me, if that may not immediately overturn that tax law, but if you had even if Democrats controlled just the House, which they could do next year, that would enable the Democrats to hold hearings, call for testimony, do investigations, any number of things to make life much more difficult for the Trump administration and for the people and the people in the administration who are all riven with conflicts of interest and with self-serving motivations. So it seems to me the more immediate thing is to go after, we've got 14 Republicans who are members of the House from California. Seven of them are in districts that Hillary Clinton carried last year in 2016. And those have been targeted. Two have already quit. So I think that in terms of people in California, I think that's the most attractive and most likely effective target and a goal right now than anything else.
But 11 of these 14 Republicans voted for this dreadful tax bill, which was petty and punitive, and they should be punished. But I'm not sure that they all are. What do you do about the Central Valley? How do you get rid of Devin Nunes and, most of all, Kevin McCarthy, who's now Trump's best friend?
He'll apologize for that someday. You can't. Of course, you can't do them all. This is a democracy. You can't essentially sweep everybody out of office, but you can. It seems to me. I think if a number of California Republicans were defeated this year, I think that itself would send a message to Congress about how they should conduct themselves on policy. And it seems to me if those 14 next year were only 8, I think that would make a huge difference. Regardless of what happens elsewhere, as you know, it's 24 seats have to be reversed in order for the Democrats to control the House. And who knows what will happen in New York or in elsewhere. But there's a lot of restlessness in the country right now about what Congress has done, about the tax bill, and about a whole lot of other things. So I don't know. There's no way to know this. And there are all kinds of things that can happen between now and November that are unpredictable, both in this state and nationally. And we don't know what Trump, maybe he's spoiling for a war with Korea, North Korea. That would change things if that happened. There are all kinds of things that could happen that we don't know. But it seems to me, in terms of effectiveness at this point, I think all the lawsuits that Becerra has filed and the legislation that's been passed, and the legislature, ever since Trump was elected, has been kind of an echo chamber of anti-Trump actions of one kind or another, resolutions and votes and bills. And so, but it seems to me that in terms of immediate effectiveness, probably the best thing is to try to get to replace those Republicans with Democrats. And I think there's a danger here, too, by the way, and that is that the Democrats will blow things by internal fighting about between the left and the moderates, which is already going on, as we know, both in California and in Washington. It's going on this minute about DACA and about the budget and DACA, and should the Democrats have done what they did. So there's already those fights. Those would make the prospects next year much more dicey than if, in fact, the Democrats can keep their act together.
Well, Peter Schrag, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Schrag, who has written for The Nation for nearly a half century and is a former editorial page editor of the Sacramento Bee and a visiting scholar at the Institute for Governmental Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. And he's the author of Paradise Lost, California's Experience, America's Future. And his most recent book is When Europe Was a Prison Camp, Father and Son Memoirs, 1940 to 1941. And his latest article at The Nation is California Shows How to Beat Trump Now and in November. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by a progressive activist, and we'll be talking about the difference between grassroots candidates running for office and those the Democratic Party establishment favors. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining me in the studio is Howie Klein, who's a progressive blogger and activist, as well as a concert promoter, disc jockey, music producer, record label founder, record label executive, and professor of music, who was president of Reprise Records from 1989 to 2001. And he writes at downwithtyranny.blogspot.com. Welcome to Background Briefing,
Thank you, Howie Klein.
So good news, though. Downwithtyranny.com, that'll do it.
That'll do it.
You don't need the blog.
Okay. Downwithtyranny.com. And, of course, we do have a tyranny of the minority. So the main question would be, how come, if this guy's got 35%, what's wrong with the 65%? What the hell's going on in this country where you have the most reactionary laws? I mean, look what's just happened with Trump. You know, he wants to bring back coal. And now he slapped a tariff on solar, which is going to kill solar. So the clock's being turned back right, left, and center. I don't understand why the majority in this country, I mean, more women marched on the weekend than the Tea Party would be able to field in 20, 30 years. And yet the Tea Party runs the Republican Party. So what's your explanation, since you're down with tyranny?
My explanation is that a huge number of Americans just don't vote. And the reason that they don't vote is because they've got this idea, and for good reason, that the best that you can get out of the Democratic Party is lesser of two evils. And, you know, although I try to help Democrats get elected, not all Democrats, but progressive Democrats, I have a PAC. That's the only thing about me you didn't mention. I have a PAC called the Blue America PAC, and we are out there trying to raise money for progressives. There are no Republican progressives, so they're Democrats. However, a good portion of the Democratic Party is at best the lesser of two evils. At worst, they're the same. Democrats go crazy when you say they're the same, but they're really terrible. In fact, I was just writing before I came over here today about Nancy Pelosi tomorrow will be campaigning for Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I mean, to a lot of progressives, you say the name Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and what do they think of? Right away, the person who stole primary after primary after caucus after primary from Bernie Sanders to benefit Hillary Clinton. And, you know, that will discourage people from voting if they think that the system is rigged against progressives. And to be honest, many times it is. There was a wonderful story this week that was all about the Colorado 6th District, where there's an awful DCCC, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee candidate, who's a crook. He's just a lawyer who was helping payday lenders and doing everything he could against ordinary families. And the DCCC is trying to pass him off as, oh, some great military hero. And, you know, they're doing whatever they can for this really corrupt, crooked, conservative candidate named Crow. I think his name is Jason Crow, but his name is Crow. And there's a really good candidate who's running as well, and the DCCC is going out of their way to harm him. And how do they do that? They do it by telling donors not to give him money, telling labor unions not to support him. That's what they do. And in this particular instance, what got me to write about this is that Steny Hoyer, who's number two in the Democratic caucus in Congress, was in the district and telling this guy, get out of the race. Just get out of the race. You're just making trouble. We don't want you in the race. And I have lived for decades of watching Steny Hoyer and Rahm Emanuel and other corrupt Democratic bosses from the establishment end of the Democratic Party doing that to candidates, going to progressive candidates, to reformers, and telling them, get out of the race. We don't want you. So when you ask a question like that, the answer is, there is some sense in people not wanting to vote. Why would someone want to vote for this kind of corruption? It's absolutely awful.
Right. Well, that applies, for example, in Arizona. We got Kyrsten Sinema running for the Senate. She's a congresswoman who votes with the Republicans something, I don't know, 80% of the time.
That's right.
So she's going to be running against Martha McNally, a Republican, as an A-10 fighter pilot. So I would vote for the authentic Republican, not the fake one.
Well, a lot of people say that. Yeah. Now, well, we don't know if McSally is going to get that nomination because the Republicans have a big primary. So they've got like two psychopaths running. One is this woman named Kelly Ward, who's completely crazy. And the other one was the other one's crazy too, but Joe Arpaio, the crazy sheriff.
Exactly.
So we don't know who's going to actually be the nominee. Of course, the Republican establishment wants it to be McSally. But, you know,
they may have the same problem.
They very much have the same problem.
Right. And again, I'm joined in the studio by Howie Klein, who's a progressive blogger and activist, as well as a concert promoter, disc jockey, music producer, record label founder, record label executive, and professor of music, who was president of Reprise Records from 1989 to 2001. And he writes at downwithtyranny.com. So, our previous guest, of course, was talking about how California's fighting back against the war in California by Trump and the Republicans. We don't need to list how they're attacking this successful progressive state with making us pay more in taxes, going after marijuana laws, sanctuary cities, offshore drilling. So the point that he made finally was that at the end of the day, the greatest hope for California is that they can flip, if not the 14 Republican seats, that's not going to happen. But 11 of those 14 Republicans voted for this terrible tax bill that's going to hurt their constituents. What's your reading on the chances? Because you'd only need to flip 24 seats. So California could go a long way towards taking back the House.
Right. California is probably not going to be able to flip even half of the 24 that's needed. But my belief is that, don't worry, because it looks to me like there'll be 50 seats that flip, or even more than 50 seats. I see a big blue tsunami coming. But in California, there's probably 7, 8, 9, maybe even 10 seats that will flip. So the Democrats are going to pick up quite a lot of seats. And you know, my fear is that the DCCC, again, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, is screwing it up. They are going out of their way to try to push conservative Democrats. I'll give you some examples of that. But first, I want to give the good news. Of all the regions in the country, so the country is divided by regions, there's one good regional vice chair of the DCCC. He's literally the only good person who works at the DCCC, and it's a local California congressman from the beach cities and Santa Barbara and up into Malibu. His name is Ted Lieu. Ted Lieu is fantastic, and he's not allowing the DCCC to do what they're doing in every other region. So what they do is they favor the conservative candidates, they favor the corrupt candidates. And when I say they favor the corrupt candidates, that's literal. They want someone who's going to be part of the money game and go with the lobbyists who then pay off the party. That's what Steny Hoyer does. That's what Pelosi does. That's how they get their power. And
but
Ted isn't allowing
that. Does that mean these people
that.
Already have money, though? Is that what that's?
Some of them have money.
Yeah.
Some of them
isn't
are self-funders.
They like self-funders, don't they?
Yeah, they certainly do. But Ted isn't allowing that. Ted is enforcing neutrality in the primaries, and he's successful at it. Mm-hmm. So, and that's good. Now, there are quite a few districts that Hillary won in her race against Trump, and the DCCC theory is we can pick up any of those districts. Well, I don't know if that's a good theory. The better theory is there's going to be a big blue wave, and we better have good candidates in every district. Now, some of them, you know, there's a thing called the PVI, which tells you how Republican or how Democratic a district is. So, in a normal election, anything for a Democrat to look at a district, anything that's over a PVI of R plus 1, R plus 2, R plus 3, maybe even R plus 4, that's too high to go. But in a wave election like we're going to see now, a PVI even of R plus 10 is doable. That's why I'm saying we can get 7, 8, 9 Republican seats for the Democrats. You know, a lot of people don't realize this, but last night, so Tuesday, there was a state legislative race in Pennsylvania. It's a little sort of district in the Monongahela Valley, so McKeesport, which is southeast of Pittsburgh. So it's not like a super Democratic district, but Hillary won it with 53%. So she won it, and 53% isn't bad in a presidential election, and it's generally a Democratic district. That gives Democratic candidates around that number. Well, last night, the Democrat who won there, who happens to have been an African-American, and that district has never elected an African-American before, he won it with over 70%. So that when I'm talking about a wave, that's what happens in a wave. You know, for a year before it, you're seeing these districts, even if they don't swing all the way to give a Democrat a win, they're going up by 20 points. Right. So in a district that has R plus 5, R plus 6, R plus 7, those Republicans are swept away. They lose. You know, if someone swings, like happened in Pennsylvania last night, well, if all you need is 10 points, you win. So, now, in California, when you look at the districts like, for example, San Diego, the northern San Diego County, southern Orange County, that's California 49. So right now, the congressperson is Daryl Issa. Mm-hmm. Daryl Issa saw the handwriting on the wall, and he's taking a walk. He's leaving. He knows he can't win that district. That's an even district between Republicans and Democrats. He knows no chance, and he left. He's hoping to walk into another district because the district next door, there's a congressman named Duncan Hunter, a Republican, and he's likely to be indicted. He was stealing money. He got caught. And if he gets indicted, then Issa will try to run in that district instead. But in terms of California 49, that's a sure win for a Democrat. And now there's a big fight among Democrats. Now, this is really funny, Ian. So there are several money candidates, establishment money candidates, who think they can just march in and win. Now, Doug Applegate is the progressive candidate. He was a Bernie supporter. He came within about 1% of beating Issa last time. Issa wound up spending $6 million, a lot of it his own money. And this guy, you know, managed to spend a couple of million dollars, but that's a big disparity. Right. In a wave election, that kind of disparity doesn't matter. Right. An incumbent who the wave is going after his party, an incumbent can spend five times more than the challenger and still lose. Right. And I'm not just saying that off the top of my head. I looked at the two wave elections that were recent in 2006 when the Democrats won and in 2010 when the Republicans won. And what I just said is borne out in district after district. Dozens and dozens of districts where candidates thought, "Well, I'm okay. I'm going to spend $5 million, and my opponent only has $1 million, right. And they lost."
Right.
So, well, in any case,
that's the Michael Huffington syndrome.
Yes.
So let me, and of course, Applegate is a Marine colonel, too.
Talking about the most Marine district in the whole country.
Camp Pendleton, there, yeah. Right there. So let me ask you, though, just to follow on from yesterday's interview I did with a co-author of a new study from the National Bureau of Economic Research, From the Bargaining Table to the Ballot Box, Political Effect of Right-to-Work Laws. And one of the points that he made was that these right-to-work laws are drying up money because unions have to fight to survive. They can't give money to the Democrats as they normally used to. Plus, unionization is going down and down. But the other factor that he brought up is that because of the fact that Democrats have moved towards Wall Street and away from unions in terms of their funding, they don't run blue-collar candidates. And blue-collar candidates would have won in those three districts that Hillary lost, the three states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. You're helping Randy Bryce, who's a steel worker, a blue-collar guy, running against Paul Ryan. Sounds like we need more Randy Bryces.
Very much so. And Randy has been going around the country helping other Democrats, other blue-collar Democrats, which is really satisfying to see. But, I mean, I'm not just helping Randy Bryce. I was one of the people who recruited Randy Bryce to win. I'm the one who connected Randy Bryce up with his campaign team, his campaign manager, his consultant. And Randy is a phenomenally good candidate. And of course, like you said, he's actually an iron worker. And Randy is looking so good in his district. I mean, the polling, the focus groups show him winning, that it's likely that Paul Ryan won't even run this race.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an amazing. That in itself, getting rid of the speaker, is huge.
It's in our lifetimes, it's only happened once before. And right. that was
against the Republicans with Dave Brack going after. Oh, that was Cantor. Yeah, oh, Foley. I was thinking about Eric Cantor. He wasn't the speaker.
No,
but he
was the majority leader.
Yeah.
But what happened up in Washington State, eastern Washington, the Spokane area,
right.
they started this rumor about Tom Foley. He was the Democratic speaker.
Yeah, yeah.
They started the rumor that he was gay, which he wasn't. He was a happily married man. He was not gay.
Right.
And it was funny because it was an accident, because someone was running for the first time who was gay named Foley. It was Mark Foley.
Oh,
so it was kind of ironic
Republican,
that happened.
Right.
Yes, a Republican.
Yeah, because
they started the rumor about Tom Foley. He lost the seat.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, the fourth-ranking Republican in Congress, what's her name? Kathy McMorris Rogers. She has three names, and she has that seat now.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman who's running against her, Lisa Brown, is with the former majority leader of the state Senate, and she's the chancellor of the University of Washington in Spokane. Looks like she's going to beat her. So what you have is the speaker is going to be is going out in Wisconsin, and then the district where the Republicans took Tom Foley's seat, Democratic speaker.
Right. Little poetic justice there.
Yes,
yeah.
A very good one.
Yeah, so I would love to see Devin Nunes knocked off in the Central Valley.
Not a
progressive area. I don't think there's any way of getting rid of Kevin McCarthy, who's Donald Trump's new best friend.
Right.
But what about getting rid of Nunes? Is there any way to do that?
Yes. Nunes is somewhat vulnerable. It's a very Hispanic area. And the key to getting that to happen, is to combine the Anglos who are angry about the Russia thing. Because there are a lot of people up there who are angry with Nunes because they feel he's conspiring with Trump on behalf of Putin, and there's a lot of anger about that. But you need to combine them with the working class Hispanic people up there. And it can be done, but it will only be done if you have a Hispanic candidate and the establishment is insisting on this guy, Andrew Janz. Now, I have an interesting story about Andrew Janz, because when he first decided he was going to run, I had no idea what he was like, and I got in touch with him. And I started asking him questions, and he didn't know anything about what the Democratic, this energy in the Democratic Party is about. I said to him, how do you feel about single payer? He didn't know what it was. How do you feel about Medicare for All? He had never heard the term. He just didn't know what it was. And then he said to me, can I tell you the reason I'm running? I said, absolutely. I'd love to hear why you're running. He said, there are two reasons I'm running. One of them is because the death penalty doesn't get used enough. And the other is because we need more respect and more support in the Democratic Party for the Second Amendment. People need to be able to go out and get guns.
So this is the guy.
He's a Democrat.
That, yeah, but he's running as a Democrat. But this is the guy that the Democratic establishment is supporting as opposed to the Latino guy?
Yes. There's a Latino guy named Ricardo Franco who is, he's a Latino guy from a blue-collar family. But you know what? He went to University of Pennsylvania, and he is a very, very, very well-educated, well-spoken guy who knows how to write and could be and is a grassroots activist. He would be a really, really good congressman, but the establishment would rather see a progressive lose and Nunez win than back a progressive. That's how they are, not just up there, but in Washington, D.C. as well.
So that, to my mind, means that the Democratic establishment has not learned a damn thing from what happened with Bernie Sanders. And it's the same attitude. They're still thinking like Hillary. For reasons I don't understand, Hillary never ran him as a VP, never offered Bernie the VP slot. She chose this guy who did absolutely nothing for her, Tim Kaine. It was a complete locks.
No, slightly more conservative than she is.
Right, but he went nowhere. And Bernie would have got her over the top with a huge
certainly
margin.
In Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, maybe even in Ohio.
Exactly. And the fact that he did so well and drew all those crowds and brought all those young people in and fired up the base, it's like it never happened to them. What is their problem? Why don't they recognize that this guy is an ally of theirs, that they could build on this alliance? And by the way, one of the most interesting books written about American politics was Strangers in Their Own Land by a sociologist at Berkeley. She spent 5 years down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, studying the people who vote for Trump. And the one person that the Trump voters respected on the other side was Bernie Sanders. So he has traction in the alienated white working class. So what's their problem?
You know, before I tell you what their problem is, I want to tell you that Trump's main pollster said that we couldn't have, about the Trump campaign, he said we couldn't have beaten Bernie. Mm-hmm. Even they recognized that they wouldn't have beaten Bernie. Hillary was the candidate of the status quo in an election year when everyone wanted change. People wanted change, and she was against change. That basically, she was the conservative, not in terms of a conservative party, not even in terms of conservative policies. Mm-hmm. She was the conservative in terms of being the avatar of the status quo.
So, but why haven't they learned? Why are they still running the party as though Hillary's a candidate?
For their own benefit. They all get rich from these people. That's their bread and butter personally.
Yeah, that, but they don't want but change. But rank and file don't like being in the minority.
No, the rank and file don't. That's why they don't vote.
No, but I'm saying, I mean, the members don't like being in the minority.
Right.
Why?
They're being sold a bill of goods. So it goes back to 2006 when Rahm Emanuel came up with this whole theory, and they still live by that theory. Someone told me something really funny today. I use it in my blog. I can't even remember who it was anymore who said it to me. It might have been Alan Grayson telling me this, that if you keep doing the same thing, you keep getting the same results. Right. And he said it much more elegantly than that. But that's exactly what the DCCC does. They keep doing the same thing and getting the same results.
Well, they've got to stop being afraid of their base. They've got to start embracing their base as opposed to running away from them. It's crazy. And the blue wave that you talk about, let's hope they don't shoot themselves in the foot.
My first post for tomorrow morning, which I've been working on, is called Can Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer Stop the Blue Wave?
Well, let's hope the answer to that is no. And I thank you for joining us here in the studio, Howie Klein.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Howie Klein, who's a progressive blogger and activist, as well as a concert promoter, disc jockey, music producer, record label founder, record label executive, and then professor of music, who was president of Reprise Records from 1989 to 2001. And he blogs at downwithtyranny.com. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Grant Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.